Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robertson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. My guest today is Alec Karakatsanis. He is the founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps. He is also the author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. He also writes, at the moment, Alex Copaganda Newsletter on Substack. He can be found on Twitter at Equality Alec. Alec, welcome to Current Affairs.
Thank you so much for having me, Nathan.
The Copaganda Newsletter that you publish now, one of your main targets is mainstream media reporting on criminal punishment, on prosecution, on policing. And I want to devote the bulk of our conversation to going through the various ways in which people's perception is manipulated through the way that the press presents the facts. But I think where I'd like to start is with the big thing that is left out. Because I think as I read what you write on this, what comes to mind first is that so many of the press accounts, yes, they distort things in various ways, yes, they're pro-police, but they're missing the big picture. Let's start with the big picture of the American criminal punishment system. The things that we should all bear in mind in any conversation about this. The starting points for our discussion that we don't want to get lost in our news analysis.
I think the most important thing that is unstated in almost all media coverage of the criminal punishment bureaucracy and more broadly issues of safety is that the United States is currently caging human beings at a rate that is unprecedented, not only in its own history, but in the recorded history of the modern world. So we're caging people at five times the rate that the United States did when Nixon was president. We're caging people at a rate 5 or 10 times what other comparably wealthy countries do right now, to this day. Those countries, by the way, have significantly lower levels of violence. So what we know from our own history and what we know from studying other societies all over the world is that if more cops, prosecutors, judges, probation, parole officers, prison guards, prisons, surveillance technology, companies profiting at every stage of that process, if that giant metastasized bureaucracy made us safe, we would have the safest society in the history of the world. Those things don't make us safe. So there's this core, you know, denial in almost all of the coverage of just what an outlier we are in terms of the sheer scope of the project that we've undertaken to take people away from their homes and schools and churches and jobs and communities and treatment, and put them into this government-run system of cages, concrete, and metal. And that is an incredible omission, you know, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, there's the omission of the vast number here, and then there's the omission of the human reality. You have been using the word caging, where some people might use the word incarceration. And I take it that what you are trying to draw people's attention to is the human reality of family separation, of forced labor, of debtors' prisons, of the real horrific deprivation that we are inflicting upon people when we make the decision to, quote, incarcerate them.
Absolutely. I think the second big thing that's missing is we have, as a society, and largely because many people who aren't directly impacted by the system, who don't have family or in the system, don't understand the sheer horror of what it does to people and their bodies and their minds. And so the second big thing that's missing is any reasonable or reasonably accurate or reasonably faithful accounting of the incredible brutality. What is it like to be in one of the 3,150 jails around this country, or the 1,800 prisons, right? What is it like to be deprived of sunlight and fresh air and the ability to hug your child? What is it like to be sleeping on the floor covered in mucus and feces and blood and urine? What is it like to be handcuffed and chained to a bench for 3 days straight? What is it like to be in the torture of solitary confinement? What is it like to be barred from reading what you want to read or hugging another human being? All of these things. What is it like to be sexually and physically assaulted? I mean, this is completely missing from the media coverage of what these bureaucracies are doing. And I don't think it's an accident, because if most people who aren't affected by it, if they knew what was happening to people, I think they would have a much more difficult time supporting it. I think there's a third thing, Nathan, by the way, that's missing, which I hinted at, but I think it's important to make explicit, which is that, like with climate change, there is an overwhelming scientific consensus that the root causes of crime in our society, and again, crime is a heavily politicized concept.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
But the root causes of interpersonal harm are not like policing policies or bail policies or prosecutorial charging decisions, right? The root causes are things like access to housing and early childhood education and inequality and poverty and mental illness and all of the ways in which our society destroys the bonds between human beings. Those are the causes of crime, you know, by and large. And so every time we talk about crime as if it's some phenomenon that is related to like some decision some bureaucrat is making in a police office somewhere, a prosecutor's office, we're actually going against the great weight of scientific knowledge.
Yeah, one of the things that you emphasize over and over is that we really can't allow the framing that is very, very successful that suggests that those who oppose the present criminal punishment regime are that they're soft on crime. They're sympathetic to those who commit crimes and they believe in, you know, not being so harsh. And then there's the tough on crime people who take the crimes more seriously. And one of the things that you emphasize is, no, actually, the tough on crime people are not interested in stopping the things that they say they're stopping because they are ignoring the piles of research in criminology that show that we are not, in fact, addressing the problem through harsh punishments.
I think there's at least two important points to be made on that. You know, one is this point you're suggesting, which is that if you actually were to look at the evidence, you know, reams of evidence, binders full of evidence, someone might say, about what affects interpersonal harm, then the policies that are called tough on crime are actually the ones that are increasing crime. And the policies that are called soft on crime are actually the ones that over the long term lead to a society with less harm and crime. The second, I think, point that is vital to understand is the people that market themselves as tough on crime are only treating harshly certain people accused of certain crimes at certain times. It's not like they're tough on all kinds of crime, right? They're not tough on crime committed by the police. They're not tough on crime committed by wealthy people. They're not tough on tax evasion. They're not tough on wage theft, right? They are interested in ruthlessly crushing poor people. And they're interested in using their position of power to commandeer the bureaucracy and machinery of state violence to ruthlessly target people who don't have power in our society for political ends. That's not tough on crime generally. That's treating certain people accused of certain crimes very, very harshly for certain political goals.
In case people think that what you're saying is, well, okay, but what about, you know, just like, what about the boardrooms? What about the corporations? What about the police? One of the things you document in your work is just how much wage theft and theft by police there are. When you say, oh, the police, they don't go after their own crimes, that's not a minor point. That is a huge amount of unprosecuted theft, actually.
It's absolutely orders of magnitude greater than the crime like shoplifting from pharmacies that you see lead the local news every night, right? We're talking about, and you know, estimates are difficult to come by precisely because the police and prosecutors don't track these crimes, but the experts who study it think that there's about $50 billion a year of wage theft from corporate entities, from, you know, low-wage workers mostly, right? That is five times the amount of you know, the FBI's reported property crime in this country combined. The police themselves take more property from people through what they call civil asset forfeiture, much of which is just illegal searches and seizures. They take more money on that than all burglary combined in the U.S. So when you actually look at, and it does, it's not limited to property crime. I mean, nobody's counting this, but even low reasonable estimates of police violence are that there are several million physical assaults and sexual assaults by the police every single year in this country. And so when you actually count all of those things, they would dramatically reverse all of the reported crime rates that police are currently reporting, even if you included the crimes that police and wealthy people commit.
I want to dwell on this point about what we might call real public safety, or the real reduction of, as you point out, harm. If what we're concerned with is harm, I'll just quote you here. You say the left-leaning people I know and work with every day, like crime survivors, families of victims, vulnerable people, and scientific researchers who study public safety, they don't oppose more policing only because it discriminates and crushes families of color. We oppose massive investments in more police and prisons because it doesn't make anyone safe. They know that investments in the root causes of harm are what communities need. Only by ignoring this scientific consensus can democratic elites consistently ignore the calls for more equality, housing, healthcare, and education in favor of more and more guns, cages, and cops. I think that's the critical point. I don't think it gets across at all.
I think it's a critical point, and one of the most profoundly depressing aspects of my current job, leading a national civil rights organization, is that I often find myself in conversation with Democratic politicians. And by and large, these people are profoundly lost. They have no sense of what the actual evidence is on these issues. And that's largely because they don't care. They have no sense of how to speak about these issues in a way that's compelling. They don't understand how to build a popular political project that actually brings to people the things that they want and need to flourish. And not only that, it's not that they don't understand it, you know, through happenstance or chance. There is a very intentional apparatus and set of systems around them that is producing that ignorance, that is benefiting from that ignorance. And in many respects, it's sort of intentional on the part of the politicians themselves, although I've been more impressed by their ignorance than I have about their sort of like intentional strategy. But I think there's a very powerful and sort of pervasive bubble within which these people live, where they actually genuinely believe things like, if Joe Biden goes on television and talks about being so quote unquote tough on crime, the Democrats are going to win the midterms. And I think it's a very, if you know, since your question was about the Democrats, I mean, I think it's just, there's a lot to be said, obviously, about the sort of rise of the fascist right, which is very scary and a different sort of phenomenon. But I think in terms of like Democratic political elite, who are the ones who really control local governments and local police forces all across the country, local jails, I think what you're seeing is a social class that understands at a very, very deep level that maintaining ignorance or even sort of willful blindness about these issues benefits them, because they benefit from the way that the criminal punishment system is currently being used to control and protect private wealth and property. As you know, our someone that we both like a lot, David Graeber, talks about a lot, the criminal punishment bureaucracy in this country is the threat of imminent and immediate violence at every single moment all around us. And to some degree, these Democrats who are in charge of these local city governments all over the country, they understand at a very deep level that if they're not going to deliver for people on things like equality, housing, basic healthcare, they need the force and violence of the criminal punishment system to control and manage the resulting, you know, to use their word, disorder.
But let me give you the take of someone who would say that they are just generally, they are just sincerely concerned about people getting hurt, and they fear the rollback of punishment because it would allow people who hurt people to remain on the streets. You tangled recently online with the progressive commentator Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks. Now, I actually have liked a lot of Anna's work before. I think she's dead wrong on criminal punishment, but I think it's I think it actually is a case of how people who consider themselves progressives can end up saying things that are very, very right-wing, because she pointed to a case of, I think, someone who's said had been arrested dozens of times, and then they were let out and they went and they assaulted someone. How do you respond when someone points to one of those cases where they say, oh, look at this person who should have been put behind bars and they weren't, and then they went and then they hurt someone in this gruesome way?
I don't know that person, Anna Kasparian. I've never listened to her or reviewed her work or anything like that, but her behavior in that interaction was an embarrassment. And it's hard for me to believe that, you know, someone who behaved in that way, so like willfully spewing nonsense and just such ignorance. I mean, it's hard to believe that I would not believe that person is genuinely progressive. That might be the character they're playing on the internet or something like that. But I mean, it was an absurdity. But I think her behavior in that incident was very much like, you know, going to someone and saying climate change is a real problem, and then saying it absolutely isn't a problem. There is no such thing as global warming. Did you see that it was extremely cold in Canada yesterday? What she did was she picked out an anecdote. And of course, there's going to be crime committed in our society. And where she went really wrong or got very confused, or I mean, I hate to say confusion, because when confronted with all the evidence, she still wouldn't engage in any kind of real meaningful way. So it led me to believe that there's more of like a sort of a willfulness going on here. But what she tried to do was what we saw tragically, you know, George H.W. Bush do with the Willie Horton ads: take a single incident and push people toward racist, counterproductive, classist policy proposals that actually make that very problem worse. And it's this classic kind of like using anecdote to argue against the great weight of scientific literature. You can always find an anecdote. You know, you can always find one person out there. Like the New York Times, for example, always seems to be able to find the person in a particular community who's going to say exactly what the police chief talking point is, right? But that doesn't mean that when you actually sit and talk with people, that they all share this view. And it's very similar with Kasparian. Like, because one person who was arrested many times in the past commits a crime, that does not mean that bail reform is a mistaken policy, or that the oodles of evidence showing that bail reform actually reduces crime in the short, medium, and long term are wrong, right? It's just classic kind of right-wing troll-like behavior. And it was really surprising to see from someone who I gather has been someone prominent on the left for a long time, although I've never really consumed anything she's produced.
So what you're saying here is, I think this is very important, because this gets to some of the tropes and tendencies that we see in the press that we need to be on the lookout for. And you pointed to the example of anecdote. And obviously, in a lot of the reporting on the record of progressive prosecutors, what you'll get is the story of, you'll get the, you know, they'll put the victim's family of someone who was subjected to a horrible crime, and they'll say, well, the perpetrator got this deal and they were let out on the streets. But what you're saying is, but what we have to do is we have to ask, do the policies work? What is the trajectory here? And with bail reform, you say that it's not just a matter of being sympathetic to people who are put, who are kept in jail because they can't afford to pay bail. It's actually that it helps.
Let me give you a couple of examples. So to take bail, which you brought up, what we know from the actual scientific evidence studying millions of cases across the country is that when you jail someone because they can't pay bail after their arrest, you destabilize their life. They lose their job if they had one. They lose their place in a homeless shelter if they had one. They get their medication interrupted if they're taking medication for any type of mental illness. They get physically and sexually traumatized in the jail. They're separated from their families. They can lose their apartment or their house. Jails are what we call criminogenic. They lead people to commit more crime in the future. So when you jail someone for even 2 or 3 days after their arrest, you are actually making it more likely they commit crime in the future, as opposed to, for example, trying to understand what it was that led that person to come into the criminal system and trying to address the needs that they and their community have. Those needs can often include things like helping people find work, helping people find housing, helping people find social workers who can support them, helping people find the therapy that they need, getting people into the right community-based programming, right? These are the things that the actual evidence shows us to work. Secondly, like when you invest extraordinary sums of money in incarceration, you're actually not investing that money in the things that actually lead to a reduction of crime over the long term, like early childhood education, et cetera. And local governments all over the country, you saw this with COVID, they actually used much of the COVID relief money for police overtime, surveillance technology, weaponry, jails, things like that, as opposed to public health and safety. These have incredible consequences in the future for things like crime. And then the second example I want to give you is just a war on drugs. You know, people like Kasparian would say, well, you see someone on the street, they've been arrested for fentanyl possession 10 times, you should jail them that 11th time they're arrested. But when you think about how that policy plays out over the course of a whole society, we've been doing that for the last 40 years. We have arrested tens of millions of people at trillions of dollars in cost. We have separated millions of children from their families. We have firebombed and chemical bombed much of Latin America. We've surveilled the communications of billions of people, all in the name of this war on drugs, right? And if you look at drug usage rates now, drugs are more potent than ever. There are orders of magnitude more overdose deaths than there ever have been. Young people are using dangerous drugs at higher rates. By every conceivable measure, the war on drugs has been an utter failure. And you can't just look at, like, you know, if one person is arrested, Kasparian wants to just lock that person up, right? You can't look at any particular anecdote and understand social policy more broadly. And I think that's one of the big fallacies that she was exhibiting in that dialogue.
Well, can we also talk about the kind of dehumanizing assumption that is built into seeing people as criminals? You know, with if someone, there's often this discussion about what do we do with criminals? What do we do with violent offenders? You know, that reduce a person to the particular harm they've committed, and that make it easier for us psychologically to not think about the moral implications of, as you say, violently seizing someone and putting them in a cage, which I think is only possible if you conceive of them as kind of an animal, kind of like a wild animal that needs to just be put in a cage because there's nothing else that you could possibly do.
I think there's this incredible fallacy among many people who, you know, don't have any experience with the criminal system that people commit so-called crime. And again, you know, crime is defined by people who own things in our society. And, you know, police and prosecutors are only looking for some crime by some people some of the time. But there's this tendency to define people who've committed a crime as bad people. And they committed a crime because of that evil. That just fundamentally, in my experience, misunderstands human behavior. The vast majority of times when people hurt each other in our society is not because the person is irredeemably bad or irrevocably dangerous, but because of very particular circumstances in which they found themselves. And we have control to a large extent, not completely, but we have control to a large extent over those circumstances. So when you think about, I was a public defender for years and have represented many, many hundreds of human beings charged with offenses. I have never met more sociopaths than I met when I was in the Harvard Law Review. And I never in my work as a public defender representing people accused of crimes met anywhere near the number of sociopaths that I've met now that I interact with local politicians a lot. And I think what we have to understand is that many of those people are willfully hurting people every day too. They're committing things that are immoral. They're doing all kinds of things that hurt other people intentionally, unintentionally, negligently, recklessly, right? Many of them are actually crimes as well, right? So wealthy people take $1 trillion in taxes every year, right? There is absolutely rampant sexual assault at every major American elite university. If you look at any reasonable metric, people across our society are committing significant amounts of harm. That does not make everyone who hurts someone a bad person based on an incident in which they hurt someone. And it's much more productive and much more consistent with the evidence if we try to understand, how did someone come to hurt someone in a particular moment? How do we repair that harm in a way that doesn't actually make that person more likely to commit that same harm in the future? And our system is doing exactly the opposite when it puts someone who may have committed a crime that's connected to a mental illness, puts that person in solitary confinement for 3, 5, 7, 10 years. What is the theory there for how that person, when they get out, is going to be in a place to avoid situations like the one that led to them being incarcerated in the first place? And when you think about how so many other countries and other societies are able to grasp this and are able to put in place minimally basic policies, most of these countries don't even have great policies, but there's policies of like minimal adequacy that don't see them caging such huge percentage of their population. You have to wonder sort of like, who is benefiting from the way we're doing it in the US? Who's profiting from it and why?
Yeah, well, one other thing that you've cited before that I wanted to make sure we get on the table is the way that, as we say, when you throw someone in a cage, you're treating them like an animal and you're not really accounting for the true extent of the violence. But you cite the point that putting someone in prison takes years off their life. So if we think that prison is softer than the death penalty, we need to face the fact that what we are actually doing is literally taking a portion of their life, and not even just the portion that they're going to be spending in a prison.
This is a really profound point, and one of the, I think, key things that the media conceals from people. And every year a person is in prison takes about 2 years off of their life. And we right now in the US are incarcerating so many people for so long that the average US life expectancy is almost 2 years less than it would otherwise be if we incarcerated people at the rates of other comparable countries. This is a profound omission in mainstream media. I think many people don't understand that both because prison kills people and because prisons and jails are vectors of disease, they are deeply harmful for overall life expectancy. And it's astonishing to me that when the media covers crime and when it covers our reaction to crime through the punishment bureaucracy, it doesn't tell people that overall these systems are killing people and they're killing all of us.
Now, your newsletter is called Copaganda. Perhaps you could define that term for us and give us a couple of examples of what would constitute what you would classify as copaganda.
I think Copaganda is a very particular type of propaganda that is designed to get people to support the punishment bureaucracy as it's currently constituted in this society. By that, I think, I mean, you know, let's do examples. Like, I think one major function of Copaganda is it wants to narrow our conception of harm to only those types of harms that the police and prosecutors and courts deal with. So, for example, Copaganda focuses us on certain types of interpersonal harm, shoplifting, burglary, robbery, murder, the kinds of crimes that like the police are likely to choose to arrest people for and patrol for, etc. But it doesn't steer us toward much more significant types of harm. For example, water pollution crimes or air pollution crimes, which both kill orders of magnitude more people in this country every year than all murder combined. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, the amount of tax evasion is about 63 times all other property crime combined. And so one of the first functions of Copaganda is to get us really focused on a very narrow range of harm, which the police call crime. And even among things that are criminal, we're not focused on it, on the things that the police don't track. So that's number one. Another example of this, by the way, is the many decades in this country in which sexual assault and child sexual assault were basically ignored by the media. The police don't track those things. They rarely arrest people for those crimes. And so it was basically completely ignored. In fact, the police themselves were sitting on hundreds of thousands of untested rape kits. And they were choosing instead to use their resources to arrest people for low-level drug crimes. The police in this country over the last 10 years have arrested more people for marijuana possession than all violent crime combined. So that's one function of Copaganda, getting us focused on all the wrong things. The second function is, having narrowed our focus on all the wrong things, the police constantly benefit from having us thinking that crime is increasing. And so you'll note in media surveys over the last 25 years, people consistently are wrong about whether a reported crime in their jurisdiction is increasing or not. A third, you know, major function of Copaganda, and I think this is probably the most insidious and the most important, is, contrary to all available scientific evidence, Copaganda gets us to link crime and safety to the little policy tweaks that these bureaucrats make. People are constantly told that, like, what the police are doing or criminal sentencing or bail or whatever it is has a meaningful effect on crime, when everyone understands that whether, you know, the city of Pittsburgh hires 10 more cops or not, or city of Los Angeles hires 200 more cops or not, large social crime trends are driven by things like poverty, housing, and healthcare, right? They're not driven by little tweaks in bureaucratic policy like sentencing someone to 10 months instead of 4 months, or 7 years instead of 4 years, right? So that's a third function of Copaganda. And then I think the fourth function of Copaganda is a complete and utter omission and sort of sweeping under the rug of the violence and the harms of the system, like the ones you were talking about earlier, so that people don't understand the full scope of the harms these systems are causing.
It's true that the media has a major role in drawing people's attention to the wrong thing, but how do you respond when someone says, well, in fact, personal anecdote, there was just last week, there was a shooting like 300 feet from my own house. The police came. I was glad the police came because two guys were shot and it was very, very scary. When people say, okay, well, I agree with you on wage theft and all that, but also I'm scared to go out at night because carjackings have been increasing this year in the city, which as I understand, they actually have in this particular city this year. You know, what do you say to people like that whose perspective, who demand tough on crime policies out of, out of fear?
I have devoted my life to doing this work precisely because I care about harm and violence. And I want us to adopt policies that actually make those shootings less frequent, actually bring safety to these communities. And one of the most offensive, grotesque things about propaganda and about the current media system is that it is pointing us toward all of the wrong solutions. We have the most heavily incarcerated and heavily policed and heavily surveilled society that we've ever had. And it is not reducing the amount of interpersonal violence in our society. It does not work. The police do not prevent these shootings, right? There are many factors at play, but the most significant ones are the root causes of social and interpersonal harm. There's other things too, like the extraordinary availability of guns in our society, et cetera. But what I say to that person is, I'm right there with you. I don't want there to be shootings, but police, prosecutors, and prisons are not the answer to a society with less crime and less harm.
And you know, so when you see headlines like in the New York Times, this is one of the ones you cited in your newsletter, they wanted to roll back tough on crime policies, that's in reference to Democratic politicians, then violent crime surged. There's just so much wrong with a headline like that and so much to unpack.
I mean, I wrote a lengthy newsletter about that, you know, and every week I'm publishing a newsletter or two that really takes these examples from the New York Times, from the Atlantic, from the Washington Post, from other news outlets, and goes point by point through them, through the errors that they're making, through the assumptions that they're making, through the sources who they cite and why, the turns of phrase that they use, you know. That headline that you just read, you know, there's too much wrong with it to get into it all right here. But one of the first things is it asserts that these Democratic politicians wanted to do certain types of reform. That is a very controversial claim. And one of the things that we see all over the media is accepting the stated motivations of powerful people as their actual motivations. We see that not just in propaganda, but in forms of government propaganda, all of it. You know, George Bush saying, you know, he was invading Iraq because he wanted to spread democracy, right? That's an obvious example that to many liberals at the time rang false. But every single day in every paper around the country, you see things like the police are doing such and such because they want to reduce drug crime, right? When in fact, the reason that police are doing that action might be to get more overtime pay or to seize more property through civil forfeiture or because like in the case of Breonna Taylor, because there are real estate development interests that actually dictated where the police were doing their home raids and gentrification projects. When you actually take like a more expansive view of why the police are choosing to police certain neighborhoods and not police others and choosing to enforce some crimes but not others, it rarely comes down to any genuine concern for a particular kind of crime. And it almost always comes down to sort of bigger picture structural issues that they don't talk to us about.
So just to conclude here, finally, what should people be looking for when they read the news? What do you want them to keep an eye out for, to be intelligent consumers of media on the subject of crime and punishment?
I mean, there's so much here. I mean, I try every week in my newsletter to, you know, explain a different one of these things to people. But I think some of the big ones are the sheer volume of stories. So pay attention to the number of stories in your local outlets about, you know, police reported crime versus the number of stories about illegal eviction, workplace safety violations, air and water pollution, wage theft, tax evasion, the crimes that wealthy people commit every single day that the government also tracks. Not the police, but different government agencies are constantly tracking these things, right? And they're not being reported to you. You have to understand why. Who benefits from that? Who benefits from making you feel really urgently about shoplifting, but not urgent at all about water pollution that your kids are drinking, right? And even though there are 100,000 water pollution violations every single year in this country that we know about, that the government tracks and identifies, which is barely scratching the surface. Cancer, death, lead poisoning for kids. I mean, the consequences are absolutely enormous. So volume of stories is one big thing. Another thing to think about and to look at is when you look at these articles or listen to them on TV, who is being quoted as a source? Where are these articles coming from? Whose perspective is included? Whose perspective is ignored? Who is lifted up to you as an expert? And whose opinion is not even shared at all? I think those are some really key things that I should pay attention to.
Yeah. And I might add, and check the academic literature, because oftentimes you find that researchers have done a lot of work on studying a particular problem, and you can be misled by easy solutions and slogans, and then you find out that, as in the case of Bayl, the actual weight of the social scientific evidence runs totally contrary to what you've been told.
Absolutely.
Well, Alec, thank you for joining us here on Current Affairs, and people should follow you at Equality Alec and read your book, Usual Cruelty, and they should subscribe to your completely free propaganda newsletter at equalityalec.substack.com.
Thanks, Nathan. Always a pleasure.
The Current Affairs Podcast is a product of Current Affairs Magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs Magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs Podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening.